You're listening to the Webcomic Beacon at webcomicbeacon.com.
It's Sunday, August 5th, 2012, and this is the Webcomic Beacon Newscast with, from Blade Bunny at BladeBunny.com, Eric Kimball.
Greetings and salutations, Internet.
And from EvilSpaceCat.com, Marie Perry.
Hi!
And the author of the sci-fi novel Methuselah's Daughter, Dean Esme, who can be found at DeanEsme.com.
Hey, guys.
And I'm Jason Strasberg, the news editor for the show. So now let's get to the news. Our top story this week, coming to us from Jeff Jacks. We are actually looking at his article called "The Problem with Comic-Con." His biggest concern here is that the show seemed much quieter this year. After attending, he actually came back and wrote this review. He said that the biggest issue wasn't that the audience was getting smaller. Many other artists had stated to him that they had slower sales and traffic. What he really thinks is that it's because the show just wasn't really a bust, but that it just now seems like the comics are an afterthought at San Diego. Jack suggests that a lot of it is due to the shifting culture. SDCC hasn't really been about comics for years. Part of it comes from the fact that they can't really add any more booth space, and they can't sell any more tickets than they already have. So what you get is some people are the same people every year because, tickets are hard to come by, and no one can just walk in to see the show. And then the other problem is the panel system. People who want to see one specific panel are usually sitting there for hours, and that completely kills floor traffic. You can check out the review from Jax over at his site, and we'll talk about this a little bit more in the discussion period. Moving along, we're actually doing a special con report section this week. This may not become a regular feature of the show, but we've had a lot of news concerning San Diego and a couple other shows, and we wanted to bring it all together. We start out with San Diego Comic-Con again, where everyone should know that pre-registration for the 2013 show has already started. So it was actually this past Saturday. The reminder comes from Bleeding Cool, and if you haven't already gotten a chance or if you didn't know about it, then you probably didn't actually see that it was only given to people who had attended the 2012 show. There are no ticket sales on the show floor this year, so if you haven't gotten a reminder this year, I would check it out. Our next article comes to us from Robot 6, who directs us to Susan Maryland and UT San Diego News. She notes that while the annual event has a huge impact on the city and draws an endless number of people to San Diego one week out of the year, when it's over, it leaves no lasting impression. Unlike other arts fairs and art-oriented events in San Diego, which tend to have a positive influence on the culture or the city around them, Comic-Con keeps mostly to itself because it's usually sold out in advance, so no one who isn't already a part of it or is already a comic book fan really gets in. Marilyn also states that she talked to science fiction author Greg Bear about the possibility of opening up, relatedly, a comic books museum in San Diego as an effort to make comics more of a part of the city's institution, make it more of a landmark. So there is some kind of something else that can benefit the city. So a place for aspiring artists could congregate to become more involved in the art form. Another interesting article about the prospects for San Diego and the future of the show, you can check this out at utsandiego.com or just check out the show notes. Next up, we have a charming report from Baltimore City Paper, which details Max Robinson's first trip to Otakon, Baltimore's own celebration dedicated to anime, manga, Japanese-style video game culture. While he's been a lifelong part of geek culture, somehow Robinson's never attended an otaku convention before. You can check out his impressions in this article, so take a look, especially if you've never been to something like this show before. You may find yourself wanting to visit, and if you've been to one, you'll probably enjoy reliving the experiences through Max Robinson's eyes. And that takes care of our special con section. I'm going to pass it over to Marie for the buzz.
Thanks. We have three fun items in the buzz this week. The final rescue of the MOCCA. The great news that geek culture landmark Dr. Horrible is getting some primetime TV. And thoughts from comedian Patton Oswalt on change. Our first article about the MOCCA move. Since early this year, fans and creators alike have been worried about the fate of New York's Great Museum of Comics and Cartoon Art, also known as the MOCCA. For funding and other reasons, the museum, which preserves and exhibits historically significant works in our favorite field, was forced to shut its doors, and efforts have been ongoing for months to save the institution and its precious materials. But the good news is that on Friday, August the 3rd, the MOCCA announced that all of its assets are being transferred to the 100-year-old Society of Illustrators and will start on to be on display for at the Society of Illustrators location on 23rd Street. A treasured institution of comic fans everywhere will survive. The link of the story is coming to us from comicbeats.com, and the link is in the show notes. The next story about Dr. Horrible, yay! According to the Washington Post and other sources, fans of Joss Whedon's great superhero musical comedy Dr. Horrible sing-along blog got some fun news this week. TV network The CW will be broadcasting the entire run of Dr. Horrible to its viewers on October the 9th as part of the kickoff for the fall season. Even if you've already checked out Dr. Horrible online, you may want to tune into The CW that week to show support for more comics geekery on TV. So check out the link in the show notes to the Washington Post for more info. Our third story, finally on the buzz, we'd like to direct your attention to a recently amazing speech by comics geek and professional comedian Patton Oswalt on the subject of change. Well, Oswalt mostly talks about how he's witnessed two major periods of change have completely changed the landscape for stand-up comedians. Almost everything he says is of value to comic creators and fans, and what it all boils down to is change comes. And if you allow others to decide how to respond to those changes for you, rather than being a part of the change as well as adapting, you do your own self in. Oswalt says, I need to decide more career stuff for myself and make it happen for myself, and I need to stop waiting to luck out and be given. I need to unlearn those muscles. But we can't give you the entire of Oswalt's often funny and hilarious speech, so please check out the show links for thecomics.com for Patton's Letters to Both Sides speech, and that can be found in the show notes. And with that, that's all for the buzz, so back to you, Jason.
All right, thanks, Marie. All right, we're going to go over to Dean with education.
Thank you, Jason. In this week's education section, we have three stories for you. One on the perennial issue of women in comics, some useful information for comics writers looking for artists to pair up with, and some potentially useful information on how to go about creating and distributing comics. Over at womenwriteaboutcomics.com, Janelle Asselin, former comics editor for DC, has an interview this week where she talks about her experiences as a comics editor in getting women interested in reading and creating comic books. In the interview, she tells Elizabeth Pfeiffer what she thinks it takes to attract more female fans and female creators to the art form, although they boil down to four things: changing the cultural preconception of comics, more inclusive content, better marketing toward women, and more effective distribution. One of her more interesting quotes: it's easy to get frustrated at the slow speed of that change, but it is certainly better than nothing. But we need more books that will draw in women who don't ordinarily read comics. Hey, you aspiring female comics creators out there, are you listening? Of course, many of these things have been said before by many different people, but the times they do keep on a-changing, and perhaps Asselin's insights will resonate with some female readers and creators. We recommend checking out the interview in the show notes at womenwriteaboutcomics.com. On the subject of how to get your own comics created, one of the questions we sometimes get is this: I want to write a comic book, but I can't really draw. How do I get an artist to help me? This week, the Shiver Bureau has some tips on what to do and what not to do if this describes your situation. The basics: there are lots of artists out there whose work is online that you can find in a variety of places, like DeviantArt.com, for example. What you want to do is contact an artist with your name and your basic background, with some samples of your writing, or script a script or something like a script, an explanation of what makes your story idea compelling and worth telling, how you plan to put out and market your comic, and frankly, how you plan on paying your artist. But for more specific details, see the piece on SchreiberBureau.com in the show links, and thanks to the ever marvelous Alex Heverling for this link. Finally, speaking of creating of your own comics, Jim Zub, creator of Skull Kickers, has an interesting series of blog posts you aspiring comic creators may want to check out. Over at jimzub.com, Jim has posted 5 full entries on his process for creating comics, tips, tricks, and more. Whether you're a fan of Skull Kickers or not, we think you may find something of value in Zub's experiences and observations, so be sure to check out the show notes for that. And with that, back to you, Jason.
Thank you, Dean. Now we are going to go over to our tech section with Eric.
Thank you, Jason. We have 4 articles in tech. We're going to tech this week. We're going to talk about flaws in the iPad model, digital book buyers and the buying preferences, comic book fix, digital comics on the Google Nexus, and Comic Rocket, a page bookmarking tool. To start off with, flaws in the iPad paid content model. About a year ago, you can remember that many of the prominent magazines and newspapers were flocking to iPad for paid content as a savior of their industry. Well, now, a year later, the Huffington Post has dropped the price of its iPad magazine to zero, News Corp's Daily has chopped almost a third of its staff, and the evidence is mounting that paid content on the iPad works no better than paid content on the Internet. This is a change in the general model, and it's something that publishers are going to have to watch out for in the future. It seems like the time when you could charge people for content on iPads and iPhones is starting to wane. Our next article comes to us from Comics Beat regarding the purchase habits of digital book buyers. And this is based off a report from Publishers Weekly. It seems that people who buy books and comics on the iPhone and other digital versions are increasing their purchase of print versions as well, going up to 45% from 30%. Dovetails with the idea that we are losing people to paid content, it seems that people who buy digital books are still buying print books as well, wanting to own the actual product. Our third story in technology today is Comic Books Fix, Digital Comics on the Google Nexus. Over at DontHateTheGeek.com, David Goldblitz has a brief news of the Google Nexus 7 tablet, an Android-based tablet that, to his eyes, is one of the best electronic comics reader ever yet, with an easier interface and vibrant display. Those of us who love digital comics are looking for the perfect feel for an ebook designed well for the comics that might just find the Google Nexus tablet perfect. If anyone has tried the Google Nexus, we'd love to hear from you, but in the meantime, read one guy's personal experience over at DontHateTheGeek.com. Final story in tech today is regarding Comic Rocket. Comic Rocket's been around for a little while. This is a bookmarking tool for webcomics, and Comic Alliance speaks about the use of the Comic Rocket tool. Comic Rocket allows you to bookmark any comic that you're reading and come back to it later without having to find the tools within the actual comic. It puts a banner up at the top of the comic instead. It's been a pretty easy and useful tool to use. However, there is some controversy over this bookmarking tool because it is a service that adds comics. You can't just apply it to any comic. You have to actually register for the service. And there has been some questions about comics being added to the service without the permission of the comic creator. Now, currently, Comic Rocket doesn't put any ads on their service, and they are still in beta. How this will develop in the future is unknown, but it's something to check out for the time being. That finishes up our tech news for today. Back to you, Jason.
Well, you're going to get a little bit more of Eric in our tidbit section, so let's go on to it.
In our tidbit section this week, we have 4 articles. We have talking about the NICE convention at a theme park. We have the Toronto Comics Art Festival and Calvin and Hobbes Come Alive in Animated GIFs and Dropbox passwords hacked. So we'll start off with the comic convention in a theme park. Coming to us from Bleeding Cool, this week's story is about a webcomic convention taking place in a theme park. Instead of booking convention space in a hotel or some warehouse like a convention center, NICE, the Northampton International Comic Expo, is taking place in the historic Wicked Steed Leisure Park. Despite every indication given by its name, Wicked Steed is not a 19th century hedonistic resort, but a family-friendly amusement park featuring fairgrounds and roller coasters. NICE, it offers comic enthusiasts the unique opportunity to check out their famous comic and then scream in a mix of horror and abject terror, because Alan Moore is attending. I hear the roller coasters are also kind of scary, too. Moving on to our next topic, Toronto Comics Art Festival is accepting applications. The Toronto Comics Art Festival is accepting applications for its 2013 show. TCAF is a week-long festival celebrating comics and their creators, focusing on the art. The show is exclusive by invite only, and the application period has begun running through the week of October. If you want to apply, go to their website at torontocomics.com or the link in the show notes to apply. Our third article today talks about Calvin and Hobbes coming alive in animated GIFs. Bill Watterson's Calvin and Hobbes stays alive for regular reprints of the 10-year strip and is wandering about the intertubes this week, found something fun. A Tumblr group dedicated to creating and collecting fan-generated animated GIFs of Watterson's material. It's not clear if Watterson himself approves of this or not, but since no one is making money off of this fan-generated act, we suggest you check it out. The link is at the Comics Alliance. Comes from thecomicsalliance.com in the show notes. Last article in tidbits this week is about Dropbox. Dropbox admitted this week that someone had hacked an email employee's account and gotten thousands of email addresses off of that employee's computer. This resulted in spam being sent to members of Dropbox. Dropbox has now said they are increasing their encryption using a double encryption key system to prevent this happening in the future. But if you are a member of Dropbox, you may be getting unwanted emails and even emails claiming to be from Dropbox that are not. So be aware when you receive some emails if you are a user of Dropbox. That's it for our tidbits, and back to you, Jason.
Okay, and we're going to move on to oddities with Marie. I'm really looking forward to this one, Marie.
Yes, we have three stories in oddities today. The first one is amazing. I don't know what really it used to have to do with comics, really, but if you're a comics geek, you probably don't even have to hear more than this headline to find it interesting. All right, we all ready for this? Okay, Japanese robot bar tempts customers with giant, scantily clad dancing robots controlled by real women.
Who are also scantily clad.
Yes. We're also scantily
clad. That's
implied. Yes. But, okay, you heard it, but I will say it one more time. Japanese robot bar tempts customers with giant, scantily clad dancing robots controlled by real, scantily clad women. All right. Do you need more than the headline? And is that story true? I'm not sure you do, but if you want more information, you can check out the link to the London Daily Mail in the show notes. Only from Japan. That's all I gotta say about that. There are pictures in the article from dailymail.co.uk. Oh my god, just go look. Seriously, it's wow, man. All right. Something we have nothing to do with comics, but probably really, really fun. It sounds kind of like a great idea for a comic book, though. We have this story from comicsmix.com. The headline alone tells most of it. Zombies versus Westboro Baptist Church. The Westboro Baptist Church and its leader, Fred Phelps, are often in the news for running demonstrations against gays, against U.S. military, against the U.S. government, and so on, saying that everyone's going to hell. But there's been a lot of creative ways to respond non-violently to Phelps and Co., but this has got to be the most creative yet. Go ahead and check out the link to comicsmix.com for more details on how people dressed up as zombies had a great reaction to the Westboro Baptist Church's latest idiocy. Our last story, finally, over at io9.com, a great place. We find a lot of comic news. We spotted this hard to pass up item. Conservative radio shock jock Rush Limbaugh is somehow making his way into comic news again. You really seem to love us, don't you, Rush? Recently, it was noted that in the recent issue of the Limbaugh Letter has a cover that looks strikingly similar to fans of Dungeons & Dragons, a role-playing game. The cover features a cartoonish depiction of Limbaugh holding a spear, fighting a beastly dragon-type monster with eyes that look like the Obama 2012 campaign logo. Whether you're a fan of Limbaugh, Obama, or neither one, the thing you can tell right away is it looks virtually identical to the cover of the 2002 Dungeons & Dragons Monster Manual 2. The similarity is so remarkable that it's impossible that it's a coincidence. Although veteran eyes will probably be able to tell that it's another artist doing his own rendition of the cover. It's not just a Photoshopped copy. According to Syriac Limmar over at io9.com, the artist of the Monster Manual, Wayne Reynolds, wonders openly if the publishers of D&D will be interested in taking legal action, although it really isn't illegal to make your own rendition of a drawing of someone else's work as long as it isn't trademarked. Still, leaving us wondering, is Limbaugh a secret D&D player, or is someone just on his staff that secret D&D player? You'll find a link to the story on io9.com in the show notes if you want to go see it. All right. That's all that we've got today and the oddities. Back to you, Jason.
That was beautiful. That was beautiful. All right. That's the end of the news for this. We are going to move on to our discussion section in just a moment. So we'll see you after the break.
Hey everyone out there, I'd just like to mention that this episode of the Webcomic Beacon Newscast is sponsored by Sean Granger, the author of the graphic novel Family Bones, which has sponsored Webcomic Beacon in the past. He is now promoting his website, which is at kingtractorpress.com, with a couple of ongoing webcomics he has there, including Gene Gardens and Daddy's Girls. So go ahead and check out kingtractorpress.com.
This program is a part of the Webcast Beacon Network and is hosted on the Rampage Network. Follow us on Twitter for news links as we find them at WebcomicZ. Email us at webcomicbeaconnews@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 1-320-310-0922. Love the show? Please grab the iTunes or RSS feed. We're also on Stitcher.com with Stitcher Smart Radio, an on-demand service where you can stitch podcast and radio show feeds together for your own personal streaming service. The Webcast Beacon Network, covering and promoting creativity in the creative process since 2007. Webcomics, comic books, news, and web fiction at WebcastBeacon.com. Now, back to our show.
Welcome back to the Webcomic Beacon Newscast, and now it's time for our discussion with, as you may know, Marie Terry.
Hi there.
Eric Campbell.
Greetings.
Mr. Dean Esme.
Hello there.
And myself, Jason Strasberg. And we have our very special guest, a friend of the show, T. Campbell, whose latest projects are Gilded Age and Quilt Bag. Welcome, T.
Hey, good to be here.
All right, so we're going to start out with our discussion, some of the stories this week that really caught our attention. Now, we wanted to begin with the Nexus, I believe, Nexus One review, and Marie had actually said that you had seen it.
Yes, I have a friend who's a bit of a tech geek who happened to get one, and I saw it yesterday. I saw it. It was actually a lot smaller than I thought it was. Like, compared to the iPad and stuff, it's quite small. So I'm sort of a little bit surprised that it's kind of like the perfect comic book viewer. Like, I didn't get a chance to really play with it much, but just from the size of the screen, I mean, I personally would prefer something about as big as an iPad-ish. But this seemed quite a bit smaller. It was like somewhere between between the iPad and an iPhone size. It was somewhere in the middle.
Ooh. Okay. So yeah. Okay. So that's an interesting counterpoint to what the article is. It's really lauding this thing. Okay, let's have food for thought, and you heard it here first. All right, so continuing on, we wanted to talk about the contacting artists article as well, and I think that we'll give everybody a chance. But T, did you have any input on that?
Well, sure. I love to tell people the story of how I found my first artist. My first serious artist, I should say. I knew some artists and did very short-term projects with them in college, and that was a lovely course in everything that could go wrong. But when it came time to start bands, I thought very strongly about material and thought to myself, well, it's about science fiction people, that's where I should look. If it were a project about art history, I would be looking in galleries. In terms of bringing them in, you want something concrete for them to work on. You want to get at least a few sample pages together for them to see, and you want to have a clear, coherent plan about what benefits they will get from working with you. Something more concrete than simply the privilege of basking in your talent.
Oh.
Yeah. Offer money. This is the thing that...
Yeah, well, there are two major ways to do it. One is a page rate, and the other is a percentage division of any earnings. Obviously, the page rate is a big gamble on your part and lessens the risk on their part significantly. And that is more attractive to them if that's something that you can manage. That's what I did at first. Once I got a little street cred, I alternated between the two methods.
Yeah. The problem I often see a lot of people starting off with here, and maybe you can back me up on this, is that they assume that they can do what T. Campbell does, you know, and offer a percentage, where they have no track record of anything. And they say, I have this great idea, and I'll offer you a percentage of the profit. And unless you actually have something to back it up that there's going to be profit, no one's going to be interested in you.
So would your argument be that this is something that hits me close to home, because I've already got the one novel out, which I think would make a great adaptation to a comic. I have another whole storyline for a comic I would like to do. I've had aborted starts with three or four different artists, mm-hmm. all the way through getting to the main character sketches, first few panels done, and every time an artist has bailed on me. Yep. And I've been like, you know, what I like to do as a creator, just as a writer, is to collaborate. But it seems like most artists just want me to tell them what to do. So I'm still struggling with mm-hmm. learning, okay, do I really have to do this? I'm not going to have a collaborator. I'm just going to tell them what to do. And it sounds like what you also have to do is you just have to pay up front, at least when you first get started.
Yeah, both of those. And that's the sort of the hard lesson I had to learn. I don't know about you, T. Was that sort of your experience?
Yeah, you can't, Jason is a great guy, and then this is the actual artist I found, Jason Waltrip. But there is no ambiguity about our relationship. He does what is in the script. He will sometimes massage things that might otherwise be unclear, and every once in a while he puts his own innovations in there, but it's a situation where he's given instructions and he carries them out to the best of his ability. It's not a give and take. It's not a collaboration.
It's not like that classic Stan Lee, Jack Kirby partnership type thing. That just doesn't seem to happen, huh?
What a lot of people miss is that that's something that developed over decades. Stan spent a lot of his career, mostly the parts that people don't remember too well, but also the first couple of years of the Marvel Revolution proper, writing full scripts for people to execute. It was only when Marvel started going through this period of rapid expansion, and at the same time, Stan was getting called on more and more to be the face of the company, that he had to come up with a more informal way of doing things.
More delegating than anything else.
Yeah, so, yeah.
And giving the artist more freedom. I do see a lot of people,
both writers and artists, assuming that they can do what Stan Lee did without realizing, well, it kind of took Stan Lee a long time to get there.
And if I could jump in, you don't want an artist to do whatever the heck they feel like. The image everyone has in their head is that I'll give this artist freedom and they will just draw this beautiful, you know, it will be all so inspired. But I've had trouble with artists just going off on their own. And it completely undermines my plot. You know, suddenly good guys are bad guys. Suddenly characters appear out of nowhere that have no point being in the story because they thought it'd be fun to add it in. An artist going off on their own, truly going off on their own, destroys your plot. So you can't have that. You have to have a relationship telling the artist, you have to draw exactly what I'm telling you, because if you don't, then this crucial piece that I have there, this crucial character development that I'm planning in the future, completely gets undermined.
I'm like the person on the other side of this. I'm the artist. Like, that's where I sit. I'm on the artist side. I'm on the receiving end of these emails, and I've been collaborative with writers. And I think that that one of the things is that most of the time it's like artists, it's like you said, you get slapped a lot if we are working for a writer, because it's essentially what we're doing when you guys are sort of contracting us. You've already got your story out. You've already got it all planned out. You know, there isn't actually that much room for us to be incredibly creative because it's all been set down. It's all been written already. It kind of frustrates me sometimes when I have had a writer say, like, you know, oh, like, kind of do whatever you want. And then I do. And then they come back and they're like, no, you can't do that because it's not right. It's not the right, the uniform looks. Mm-hmm. It's not the right way this looks, blah, blah, blah. So that's one of the reasons why you do have to tell us, because we can't read your mind.
Yeah. The big mistake writers make is they say, I'm going to let this artist do whatever they want. And then when they do whatever they want, they say, hey, what are you doing? You can't make the uniform red. That ruins everything. And you said, and the artist is like, you said, do whatever I want. What I want, yes. Do whatever I want as long as it fits within my vision, which you have no idea what it is.
Exactly. But if you do want to be collaborative with an artist, don't come to them with an ironclad script or something. Be like, okay, let's talk about ideas. And let's start from the ground up. You find that person and you're like, I am looking for a collaborator. I'm not just looking for an artist. I'm looking for a fellow creative who has a creative vision, who has an interest in the same area I do. And let's sit down together and let's talk about something we would like to do as a team. And not come to an artist with a script. Because when you're coming to an artist with a script, you're essentially saying, here's my creative vision. Here's what I want to do. And that is the end of it. You've already got it all worked out. You know what you want in your head. We can't read your mind, so you're going to have to communicate it to us. And that's where that, you know, you have to tell the artist every little thing, because we are visual people. We need to be shown. Like, if you can collect materials and stuff to say, okay, I want my uniforms to appear like XYZ. Like, here's some U.S. Navy uniform, here's some old German uniforms. I want some kind of, you know, collaboration of the two, and give that to an artist. Writers work with words, whereas artists work with pictures. So you have to kind of start speaking picture language when you're talking to an artist. You have to say, oh, well, it's like this, and you give them some pictures for them to look at. And they will understand much clearer than they will if you gave them words on a page. Interpreting stuff from a paragraph and actually making it visual is an incredible skill for an artist. Most of them, actually, especially younger artists, haven't developed this very well yet. But if you're working, you want to work with a professional, somebody who is used to that type of collaboration, you're looking at professional prices.
Mm-hmm. Which is about what, in your opinion?
Well, that's a tough question. if you look at something.
Yeah, that's a whole other kettle of fish. One halfway point, if you want to invite someone to start thinking of the work as partly theirs, but don't want to, just invite chaos, is to come to them with a scene. You know, not a fully developed, here's what happens on page one and here's what happens on page 96 kind of outline or script, but a scene that reflects what you want the story to be. And they can at least work with that, draw up a few pages, and you can start deciding where you're going from there.
Yeah.
The thing about involved collaboration is it's a personal relationship, and you can't leapfrog that.
Yeah, I think that really, before you even take that first step, and both T and Marie had stated it, is that you really need to make that decision that, do you want a collaborator, or you just, do you want somebody to do the work?
There's also the option of working with multiple artists who do different things. So, like, there are different types of artists. For example, if you are working on essentially your comic Bible and you need concept art, go to a concept artist. Go talk to somebody who is used to taking concepts and turning them into visuals that can then be used to show a storyboard artist or a storybook artist, like somebody who's actually a comic artist, a sequential artist, what characters look like when they actually, and environments look like when they actually go. Or maybe you want to hire a 3D artist to do a 3D render of an important piece of technology, so that when you do go to another artist who's going to actually do the sequential art that you can afford, because that's going to be the bulk of it, then they have all of the references they need.
Yeah, and images, Google Images is your friend. Just do a Google image search and put it on every panel. But, I mean, back to the pricing. The pricing is sort of a multivariable analysis here, because you got to realize the less freedom you're giving an artist, the more it costs. So if I come to an artist and I say, draw something awesome with, with spaceships, and that's all I give them, and that's all I care, and I say, let's collaborate, let's figure out what you want to draw, let's do something fun for you, I can pay him a lot less than, here's my spaceship script, the spaceships have to look like this, everything has to be like that, because it's not fun for them, you know? And so the less control you give the artist, the more you have to pay them.
If there is a long-standing personal relationship, and you say to them, the script has a really good chance of being a blockbuster, of propelling us to greater success, and I will give you 60% to 70% of the revenues because you're doing more work than I am as the artist, then in that circumstance, you can probably get away with a whole script. But again, personal relationship, can't leapfrog it.
Well, you also have to have that track record, because a lot of artists know you're blowing smoke up their butts. Like, quite frankly, you have no idea how many people who write to us, like 12-year-olds, come and say, I've got the next best thing since sliced bread. You want to work on my project because it's going to make millions of dollars. I have no idea who you are. You know, like, almost every artist who's worth their salt knows that that kind of a pitch is probably not going to happen. That's why a lot of us are like, you know, we have to
don't write bad.
You're looking at volume. You're competing with everybody else and who is, you know, can put two words on a page, who's writing artists right, left, and center, who want somebody to draw their stuff. I mean, it's not like, you know... No problem.
But, I mean, all this kind of falls apart if your story is crap.
Oh, well, yeah, but we don't even often get to see a story before, you know, we're being asked to commit to something, because people are very protective of their stories. They don't want to share them. So we don't even get to see anything.
What?
No, we don't.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you would with me, but...
Well, I'm just saying, it's like, there is not a lot of trust on the, like, that the artist isn't going to just steal it and run away or something. So, there, like, we often are asked, and then we're like, well, can we see something that you've done to, you know, especially if it does sound like a legitimate offer, and you do have to sound professional. If it sounds like a legitimate offer, and we're like, well, we'd like to, you know, I'd like to see a sample of your script, and then they're like, oh, no, you have to sign a contract first. We're like, okay, forget that.
Yeah.
So some kind of non-disclosure agreement or something. It's like, yeah, no.
There is There is a website called Digital Webbing where a lot of comic book artists hang out. Under Digital Webbing, there is a collaboration form for people looking for collaborators. Every single post in there has everything you should that's done wrong in looking for an artist because it's like
we post the links. It was around when I got started in 1998.
Can you put that in the show notes? Because I'm going to want to explore that. That sounds very interesting to me.
It was around, and from your description, it hasn't changed a bit.
No. But, I mean, here's the thing. If you're serious about doing a comic, and this is really the good thing, because there's so many people blowing smoke out there, if you make a pitch, and, I mean, here's the thing. If you haven't created the last big thing, forget about percentages. Just forget about it. If you haven't done something that's already successful, then no one wants to hear that they're going to get a percentage of your next big success. There's no interest in that. But
unless you've got some reason that does not hinge on they're believing in your awesome talent.
Yeah.
I mean, admittedly, this is an extraordinary situation. This is not what 99% of the people listening are going to hear, but just to give you some perspective, if you've got a deal with, a poker website that has 30,000 regular readers to produce the comic strip for them, that's something worth talking about. That's something that that could stand in for having done the last big thing.
Yeah, you know, either you have a track record where you've actually made successful some things. You're related to someone really important. I'm the son of Ted Turner.
Or you're working with somebody who has a track record. I worked with somebody for less than probably optimal pay because I wanted to work with another artist who was more notable than myself.
Yeah, but I mean, you have to have something of value to begin with, or you have to have money. The nice thing is because there's so many people just trying to trick artists into working for them for free, offering a small amount of money will get you noticed. They'll say, this person isn't going to make my life miserable with stupid games.
I'd also like to address something that Marie just said about somebody wanting an artist to sign a non-disclosure agreement and some kind of contract up front before you sell your stuff. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
Not only have I published
one novel, but I've helped tons of other people on their work, and I've come across this in writers who think their idea is so goddamn unique, they got to keep it secret so no one steals it. Yeah. Let me tell you, writers, you don't have any idea that's that good.
Yeah.
No. You really
don't. I run into writer artists who are afraid to publish their work because they think it's going to be stolen. And
the opposite is true.
The conflict of interest here should be obvious.
And the fact of the matter is, under copyright law, as soon as you put it out publicly, it's copyrighted by you. So that's the, you know, if you put it out anywhere, you already have copyright protection. You're done. You put it out there. So
you're supposed to publish so that people know that the work comes from you. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And then do you actually have a case if somebody, quote unquote, steals your idea, which isn't too likely?
Yeah, but I mean, here's the thing. Working with artists, if you're starting out, you're going to pay money. The amount you're going to pay is based on the freedom you give them and also the schedule you're putting them under, because if they can work on it in the free time, it's cheaper than working on it in the long term. The amount of pages you're committing to, and sadly enough, which countries you're willing to work with. If you're willing to work with someone outside of the country, then you can get a much cheaper rate. Now, there's a downside to that in that if you're working with someone outside the country, they can just stop talking to you and take your money, and that's it. There's nothing you can do about it because filing a lawsuit overseas is next to impossible.
It's also often more difficult, like language barrier. You can get really weird translations. of your story and what your instructions were. And if you try to correct it, it can just be more of a pain in the butt.
And you're going to get an anime style, unfortunately. you're going to get not only anime style, you're going to get super anime style. And that's the price you're paying for working outside of the country. If you're looking for a traditional comic book, sadly, you got to go with the Americans.
Or Europeans that do have a very nice style. But like in general, I'd say too, it's like a lot of, especially the artists who are up there who've spent, you know, years and years honing their skills and stuff, is like we have families and need to pay bills too. And this is the way we make a living oftentimes, or at least how we try to make a living, and we can't pay our bills with promises. So that's sort of one of those things where we have to make decisions about where we're going to spend our time. And if we're spending 5 hours drawing a comic page for you for $30 or less, you know, that's not necessarily the best use of our time. If somebody comes along and says, oh, I'd like you to do a $100 illustration, please. We just make a decision.
That's the real tough part. Even if you win the lottery and get an artist to work for you for a very low price, that's a very short term sort of thing, because they're going to find a better deal and they're going to leave. What's going to happen is the pages are going to start becoming late. They're going to be poor quality, and then they're just going to disappear because they can get a better deal somewhere else. They have no loyalty to you, and don't expect loyalty to you unless you've worked with them for 10, 15 years.
Right. Yeah.
Wow, this really ballooned out.
Yes, it did.
I like that. Awesome. Okay. Well, you know, let's just touch on the Dr. Horrible and the iPad stuff, because I really want to get into the meat of San Diego. So, as we said before, Dr. Horrible is coming out on the CW, which, did anyone else have something to say besides, Eric, you want to say something other than that's cool?
Well, no, I think T and I just sort of disagree on this. I think this is the way things are going to go in the future. And it's just a lot of reluctance on a lot of sides, where it's going to be web success, then, you know, direct to video or print, you know, print on demand success, then it will get picked up by a publisher, and then it will expand about beyond that. And I think this is the model that we're going to see. I don't know. T, you had a different opinion on this?
First of all, can you hear me?
Yep.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, great. Great, because I had to readjust something. Secondly, I think it is a model that we are seeing. As you've described it, generally it can be applied to many things that have been successful, certainly in the comics field in the last 10 years. I just think that the media landscape is much more complex than that. And this is something that was created because Whedon and a few other people were out of work due to the writer's strike and wanted to do something that demonstrated they could work outside the system. You know, bully for them, and it was a shot fired across the bow of certain companies, and I'm sure that was recognized as such. But we don't see 100 Dr. Horribles. There doesn't seem to be a model to replicate a Dr. Horrible.
I also tend to think that part of me looks at the story and says, this is cool. And part of me goes, who cares about broadcast TV anymore anyway?
That's true. That's very true.
Right. Legitimization. We don't need you. Yeah. The same thing goes on whenever Scott Gertz talks about print cartoonists, but never mind.
Speaking of legitimacy, let's move on to San Diego Comic-Con, because there was a time where San Diego Comic-Con was sort of our form of legitimacy. And we have this article from Jeff Jock saying, you know, maybe it's not worth it anymore.
And the question is it just for San Diego? Or do you want to broaden that out and say, is it just for San Diego? Or is it, you know, are conventions?
Yeah.
Specifically for a web comic.
Let me state my opinions on this, because I have been brutalized by cons. I started out, I said...
Where did it touch you? Where did the bad thing happen?
Yeah, I don't want to talk about Kineticon again. So what? Many Kineticon. Tentacles and owies. I started out, I was getting some success, and I said, I'm going to go to the con. That's where everyone says you make the most money. And every con was just an utter waste of my time. And I mean, just, I would spend a lot of money, and I would make nothing back. And I tried everything. And the real problem I had was a lot of these cons, if I went to a comic book convention, they're interested in Batman drawings. They're interested in artists who can draw Batman for them and perhaps some superheroine in, you know, some sexual position. That's all they want. So they didn't care about my webcomics. I go to the anime cons. It is, you know, wall-to-wall anime giggling girls. It wasn't my venue either. And webcomics don't do, I haven't seen webcomics do that great at cons, except for a few exceptions of, you know, like Spike from Templar, Arizona, and a few others who really can work the cons, but most of the time when I talk to people, they say, yeah, we make a few, and that's about it. And I don't know, what's your opinion on this, T, because you're Mr. Con crazy.
really, it's Phil Kahn, my collaborator on Gilded Age, who is Kahn crazy. If not for his influence, I would probably be doing a lot fewer cons at this point. I would say that Phil is, on a good day, he's a hustler to rival Spike, and he understands how to work the audience. He knows how to sell without feeling like he's selling his soul. He's got a really good attitude about the whole thing, which is difficult to manage. It's difficult for anyone to succeed with anything artistically. There's a reason that web cartoonist still isn't considered a viable enough career that courses are taught about it in vocational school. It depends on the kind of material that you have and your own attitude about selling. People who have some sort of social handicap are a fairly large percentage of comics creators, and of the remainder, there are people like me who often deal in properties that aren't easy to adapt. I can't do the t-shirts thing. I think I've proven that pretty conclusively at this point.
No crossword t-shirts?
No, although one of my crosswords actually does reasonably well at every convention we've gone to. It's amazing. It's the largest one that I can print. It appeals to people who are looking for something that dazzles them like a poster, but that they can actually do something with. We've discovered a lot of things through trial and error with cons. Now, San Diego is an extreme proposition. I have never made a profit at San Diego. I've never even come close to making a profit at San Diego. And I think that a lot of people are still going to San Diego just because it seems like something they should do rather than something that gives them more money than they spend to do it. And I don't know how much longer that's going to continue. Jeff is pretty plugged into the scene over there, and if he's saying this sort of thing, seems to me maybe a signal that the culture might shift away from it in the next couple of years.
Does that mean anything? That doesn't
mean cons are not valuable. There are a lot of different cons out there with a lot of different properties.
Well, you know, the piece by Oswald Patton that we mentioned in the news segment might relate to this. It's really worth reading because, you know, he's talking about being a stand-up comic, but it seems to apply here. He's talking about when he started in comedy, how did you make it big? You got on Johnny Carson and did 5 minutes. And that was your entrance, and you are now a professional stand-up comedian who can do this for a living. And if you could never make your spot on Carson, you were done. And it almost seems like for a lot of aspiring people, if you're interested in this industry, go make a splash at a con with your portfolio. But Patton's point was the world changes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where did cons come from? What were they 20 years ago versus now? I don't know that they're the same thing. If you're trying to break in or do something interesting, I'm not sure they're that relevant anymore.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. Online advertising is cheap now. And with the $500 or so I'm going to spend on hotel rooms, travel, con tables, buying the food inside the con, which you have to take out a small mortgage to purchase, that $500 can get me so much more exposure through advertising, and that advertising directly corresponds to sales. I get about 1-5% of sales from advertising. So I know with the $500, I'm going to probably make that near closely back and get more readers. So why am I spending this on a con where I'm going to go in there? People are not interested in what I'm doing because I'm not an artist. I'm not drawing Batman. And I'm going to make a minuscule amount of sales. And frankly, with stuff like San Diego, I feel like a third-class citizen in San Diego because the video games and the movies are the things that are important there.
I've heard this particular complaint leveled at San Diego since 2002, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, not to say that there isn't some truth to it, but it is also called Comic-Con. It does still have a big comics-centered culture. There's a push and pull, I think. I don't think that comics have lost the fight to be part of Comic-Con yet. But, you know, if it's not something you enjoy, don't go.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was one of those things when I was starting out, everyone said, oh, you have to go to cons. That's how you make your mark. And I don't think that's necessarily true at all. I think you can never go to a con and become completely very, very successful. I think, look at Sinfest. I don't think that guy, Tasha's ever gone to any convention anywhere or made any public appearance. He doesn't even write in a blog. And yet he's one of the top comics out there. Hey, I win.
Well, he's tops in terms of audience. He's not necessarily tops in terms of revenue. I mean, there's a real disproportion there from what I understand. Although he's managed to figure out how to make a little money here and there. I recall him saying just a couple of years ago that he was struggling to make what most of us would consider to be a baseline income off the comic.
I think, like, for at least this is my experience with conventions, since I've been doing conventions pretty steadily for the last couple of years, but I've been very, very careful and selective about what I do. I have done San Diego Comic Con. I have done the stint in the small press area, so I do have that experience. And now I'm just only doing the ones that are in my local, like, that are local to me, that I don't have to have a hotel for, that I can bring food to because I have special dietary needs, and that I, you know, that I'm reasonably sure that I'm going to at least break even on. And there's not been one that I've gone to yet that I have not at least broken even on or made a small profit. I see it more as a brand.
Man, I envy you.
I am extremely careful and cover my bases. So I've been very lucky so far. But I look at it more as a brand building exercise and a networking exercise. It's more of a getting your brand in front of people, passing things out. I make enough to cover my costs and usually a little bit more, but it's not actually through my art 90% of the time that I actually make most of my money. And, but I have met a lot of great people. I've had a lot of great interactions. I mean, I can remember one of the most amazing interactions that I had was from San Diego Comic-Con. And it was from an ash can comic I made on a laser printer. So it wasn't even a great publication. If I'd had actually, you know, the skills I have now and I have, and if I had more professional material, I probably would have done better. But I was like, at the time, it was really like, I was last minute. I made stuff on my laser printer and went down there. But one girl bought an ash can from me for like $3 and she spent, it was her reading material for while she was waiting for the masquerade or whatever, or the costume contest. And she actually sought me out the next day and told me what an amazing comic it was and how much she enjoyed it. And that she, you know, she kind of gushed to me the next day, which is great because also one of the most horrible interactions I had was at Comic-Con too. So I'd had the horrible interaction, like, you know, the day before after she'd bought this thing and I didn't even think much of it. And then, you know, the next day she came back and totally like, I was just like, oh my God, you made my whole con. You're awesome. So I don't think there's necessarily I think there's a human factor in there, and especially, and there was the mention about selling and stuff, is I did spend time as a commission salesperson, so I do know how to sell myself and sell work, so that, you know, it does make a difference, is, you know, to actually be actively working your table. And you do have to work it. It is like a job. You do have to get up there and you do have to make, you know, be friendly. And no matter how you're feeling that day, you have to get up and be friendly and smile. And there are definitely days when I have felt less than under the weather that I did not as well as when I was feeling much more up and happy about the world. But I think there's definitely a place for it. I think you definitely have to know more about your market to make it a profitable venture for you. And I don't know that San Diego Comic-Con, especially being like sort of the playground of the big boys now and being, you know, like he was saying in this article, like sort of like the same people are going year after year because they kind of get the opportunity to buy tickets early. They, you know, people can't just walk in off the street anymore. A lot of first time people who would like to go don't necessarily get to go unless they've planned like years in advance now. It may not be it may become more of a trade show as opposed to a actual like comic convention.
The Small Press Expo, Apex, and the MochaCon, yeah, which has been in the news lately. Why they developed in the first place, and I think why we will continue to see traffic flow through them. There's a whole convention ecosystem saying that San Diego is not worth it for the beginning cartoonist. I think that's something that a lot of people can get behind, unless, you know, you're a beginning cartoonist who happens to be Shia LaBeouf.
Shia LaBeouf is
fine. Oh, that was like LaBeouf.
Shia LaBeouf.
Shia LaBeouf? Yeah. Oh, wow, so I'm wrong in two languages. Okay. fine. Shia LaBeouf. When he debuted his independent thing, of course people were going to pay attention, and enough people at San Diego are media crazy that they'd be more interested in his work than if he debuted it at a smaller show. But that's the exception that proves the rule.
Yeah. Well, I think on that note, and with the unwritten rule that we always have to end the show on the mention of Shia LaBeouf's name, because
really?
You have to. Oh, God. I wanted to thank our guest, Mr. T. Campbell. Hey, T, I wanted to give you this chance to plug what you got going on right now with Fans.
Well, Fans, the series has ended officially. And it's been running in one form or another for 15 years, and we have said goodbye. However, fans.com, the website, that's with two A's, FAANS.com, we'll be showing some sketches over the next week and then launching into Webmasters, which is my bid at writing a Spider-Man story. I can tell you this, it will be like no Spider-Man story you've ever read.
You're not going to run into trouble with Marvel with that?
This is my audition piece. This is something that I am publicly manufacturing and then sending to Marvel and thereby giving up all rights to.
I see.
That's awesome. And I encourage you to look at the site. I'm looking at it right now. You just have that quote up, which I want to read because it's awesome. It says, an estimated 95% of literate Americans over the age of 25 have written and or drawn at least one Spider-Man story. And that's a great note to start on. And that's at www.fans.com. So that I'm looking forward to that. I also want to say thank you to my co-hosts here, Mr. Eric Kimball of BladeBunny.com.
Who has written a Spider-Man story.
We're going to take a poll now. Marie Terry of EvilSpaceCat.com.
Who has not written a Spider-Man story.
And then
the five.
And Mr. Dean Esme of DeanEsme.com.
Who has also thought about but not written a Spider-Man story.
and this is Jason Strasberg who, is this flat? No, never mind. Let's just say I haven't written one before. We just want to say thanks for listening to the Webcomic Beacon Newscast. Another great week to you, and we'll see you next weekend.